Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Breaking news coming in from Bet365, and it's no surprise. Same game parlay from Bet365 just keeps getting better.
Well, it's even easier to make a bet. Choose from the most popular markets, like hits, run line, totals, and home runs. So many to choose from.
Download the app, start building your bet, and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Bedrosian throws to Sandberg, and the pitch is grounded to second base. Thompson has it, throws to first. It's over! 27 years of waiting have come to an end. The Giants have won the pennant.
Welcome back to Thompson to Clark. Brad is on vacation, though I will see him tomorrow and Wednesday. We're actually be at the park together. He's in the Bay Area, but he's unable to be online. So as I've done the last couple times Brad's been gone, grabbed a great replacement here with Jarrett Seidler from Baseball Prospectus. Jarrett, what's going on, man?
Oh, is anything going on with the Giants this week? So Garrett messages me like, I don't know, probably like a week ago, like, hey, Brad's going to be on vacation this week. Do you mind filling in? You know, we can do something Monday. And I'm like, great, the Mets are off. You know, it's kind of a little bit of a lull period. Yeah, sure, I'll hop on. We'll talk about Bryce Eldridge and Carson Wisenhunt.
That was my plan. About,
but yeah.
Yeah, we didn't plan it this way. It just so happened that as the Giants, and this is what's crazy about it, is I turn on the Giants game. Actually, even before I turned it on, and you start getting the word out, so much so that Kyle Harrison is supposed to start the game.
Yes.
And instead, like, I don't know, they said, you know, right as he was about to go out and warm up, they had to switch it, and Sean Jelly was asked to step in. And I think he got through four, but just kind of like from, I don't even know when he last pitched, but just asked, okay, you're starting now against only the Dodgers crazy lineup. Get ready for Shohei. And so then the game's kind of a blur because everybody is just in the glow of trading for Devers. So we'll get into the zone contact, the analytics, the risk on the Giants side in a second, because I think even though Giants fans are going gaga for this deal, I think there is a flip side of it. There is a risk. There is a Buster Posey-ness to this deal, which makes it his stamp rather than what Farhan Zaidi may have done. So, but let's first talk about kind of why the Giants fans are so excited. Giants are pretty porous offense, and even in the offense, I was reading Keith Law, he was like, look, even though they have a bad offense, they've actually been a lot luckier than some teams who have similar offenses to them. And so the Giants have actually overachieved per what they're doing or what they should have been doing. And so there's a little bit of a smoke and mirrors in how many runs that they've actually scored, and it's probable that their offense was actually worse than their runs scored. And now they have a guy to plug in right in the middle of the order who's going to be their best hitter, like by a good deal, by a good multiple. So right away, you were able to trade for a guy who's going to be your best offensive player. And you give up Jordan Hicks, who they gave a shot in the rotation to again, who did not pitch well. And also the gem of the deal, I think, in some folks' eyes, in Kyle Harrison. I've seen some other things where people thought that, you know, maybe it's going to be Tibbs who might be the biggest piece of it for the Red Sox. But putting a guy who can just hit third or fourth, and he's going to deliver based off of his past success and what he's been doing this year. And you don't really lose a lot out of your 25 man roster. That is a positive for the Giants, who are right in the hunt, two games back. The Dodgers would make the playoffs today. That is why the Giants fans are super excited. And from your perspective of what Devers is today, how does he fit in this offense, especially at Oracle?
So look, you're straight up replacing Dom Smith in the lineup, right? Dom Smith, a guy who his last good major league season was 2020, is basically a quad A player at this point, was literally in AAA, used an opt-out to sign there, and they just kind of threw him in there because Lamonte Wade had bombed out. So you're ultimately replacing Lamonte Wade. These are definitionally replacement level players, players that are going to be anywhere between zero war or 0.5 war or something like that. You are flipping in Rafael Devers, who is going to be the best player traded this year. There is not going to be a player traded at the deadline that's better than Rafael Devers. He's, you know, one of the 20, 25, 30 best players in baseball, somewhere right around there, and a star player. He is not a world-destroying superstar like an Ohtani or a Soto, but he's next level down. He's a perennial all-star type player, right? And he is coming in, and based on the upgrade from, you know, Dom Smith, Lamonte, Wade types, it probably takes some of Wilmer Flores' playing time. I know Flores has been pretty good this year, but projecting forward, that's probably like a 3-4 win upgrade for the rest of the season. You know, the 3 is probably about the right number that you'd project. And given where they are, that they have banked a lot of wins and the Dodgers may not be quite as good as everybody thought coming into the season, they have a real chance to win that division. They have a real chance to get a bye. They have a pretty good chance to make the wild card, even if they don't. You know, like real, I get from that sense just going for it, right? You got the best player that's going to be moved during the season. And you did not give up Bryce Eldred, so you did not give up your only top prospect, and you did not give up any significant piece of the 2025 roster. For the purpose of the 2025 roster, Kyle Harrison was in a back of the rotation logjam, right? He was up, he was down, you know, he was not, you know, that. He was the difference between Kyle Harrison and the aggregate of what they will replace Kyle Harrison with is minimal for rest of season purposes. And from that perspective, we'll talk a little bit about the downside. Everybody's been analyzing this from the Red Sox perspective, right? Which, you know, that's, there's an entire story there, and it's worth talking about in the context of Devers as a Giant too, because it's how he got there.
Absolutely.
From the context of the Giants perspective, look, you have a president of baseball operations who has clearly articulated a stars, power corner guys, big names, big spending, win now philosophy, right? That's what you've articulated when you hire Buster Posey, when Buster Posey goes out and signs Willy Adames.
And to further articulate what you're saying, Buster's on record by saying the way, so because the Giants have struck out in free agency in the past, they're going after Ohtani and Bryce Harper and all these guys, and I'm sure they would have gone after Soto as well, but the problem is that they are falling short. They're runners up on the biggest names, and Buster Posey's his rationale is that, well, we could have the money, we could match what the money is, but we have to be attractive for these guys who want to come and win, and the way to do that is to put together a team that wins or is on the precipice of winning. And that's how you attract some of these free agents. So his overall goal is to be competitive and to be a contender. And so these pieces that he's putting together are with that goal in mind. We need to stay atop. We need to be a contender. And thus, when some of these guys become free agents, we will look way more attractive to them than we have in the past.
In addition to that, attracting left-handed pull power hitters has been a significant problem for them in free agency, because if you're a left-handed pull power hitter that's maybe trying to take a shorter term deal to reestablish value or is looking at where your career milestones might end up, you're not really going to want to play in that park, right? So maybe from that context, but that player is still valuable in your park. That player is somebody that you want on your team, even if, you know, Rafael Devers might lose two or three homers a season, maybe even more, you know, although, you know, he may gain some homers to left field because, you know, it's more of a line drive opposite field hitter when he goes opposite field, so stuff like that. You might have a problem attracting, say, Kyle Tucker. Kyle Tucker is the best free agent bat this offseason. And in some ways is kind of a similar offensive profile to Devers. In some ways not, but like in the aggregate production, you know, left-handed hitter that you could reasonably expect to be 35% above average in any given season offensively. Kyle Tucker might not want to play in San Francisco if it's close, just because of that sort of thing. So there's that perspective from the ballpark, but there's also the perspective of, now that you have gotten Rafael Devers, as you were saying, that might make San Francisco a more attractive destination for Kyle Tucker, or, you know, in a couple of years, you know, Elly De La Cruz or somebody like that, right? If you start thinking down the road, especially if you establish competitive landscape. A lot of times what happens on the top free agents, this is what happened with Soto. He was picking a lot based on a lot of similar financial offers because, and we'll talk about this a little bit later too, most teams value players pretty similarly. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not that hard to project, okay, this is roughly how much a player is going to be worth. This is what he might add to our team in different sorts of, you know, non extremely obvious on-field ways. But like the top four offers for Soto were all between $710 and $765 million or whatever the numbers, you know, whatever. How, you know, because you can value stuff a little bit differently based on deferrals and opt-outs and stuff like that. But they were all within, a 10% band, right? And that tends to happen a lot. And a lot of times when players are picking between similar offers, they will think about stuff like organizational culture, winning culture, who my teammates are going to be, do I have friends on that team, location, ballpark. And I think San Francisco, and this is something that Posey even said going back to when he was a player, that San Francisco sometimes has not been an attractive destination for players, and it's important to make it one. And I think going out and making a big statement trade like this does legitimately help with that. As we were talking before we went on the air, even after this, they do not have like a ginormous amount of money committed. They could still go out and sign a Kyle Tucker type player in this upcoming offseason. But in terms of like a big corner power bat in free agency, once Vlad extended, there isn't one in next year's free agency. Now there's Pete Alonso. Pete Alonso was there in last year's free agency. Right. If the Giants wanted to make a godfather, then the Giants were interested in Pete Alonso in free agency. If the Giants wanted to make a godfather long-term offer to Pete Alonso, he would be a Giant right now. Like, that's, you know, because the Mets were not going to match at that level. And, you know, he's another example of, you know, Alonso, when he was dealing with relatively samey type offers between the Giants and the Blue Jays and the Mets, chose to work at, you know, hammer out a deal with the Mets because he was comfortable there. It's New York. They had already signed Juan Soto, things of that nature. So maybe in next year's free agency, they do become more attractive to Alonso. Although I can't, they're so stuffed at the corner infield now that I can't imagine they're an Alonso player.
You know, what's funny is that, by trading Devers, I know Bregman has an opt-out, and all of a sudden Bregman has so much leverage with over the Red Sox. It's amazing.
Right. If he walks, it's Marcelo Meyer at third base for the foreseeable future. Like, they don't have a backup plan now. I don't know if they've already got some kind of, you know, I would assume they are very confident in their ability to keep Bregman, right? Yeah, like, you would have to assume that based on the trade. But also, like, the displacement of somebody that you have under contract for 9 years in a way that's going to very negatively impact the relationship with the player for somebody that you only have under control for 1 year was odd from the second it happened.
Like when they did the deal, Brad and I were like, okay, did they sign him to play second base? Like what is the reason here? And you know what, you know, you're following nationally a lot more closely than I am because of your job. But my thought was like, okay, they're trying to do something with and be position flexible, which I think with most people who saw that deal, they're like, oh yeah, you know, they probably already talked to Devers and they've kind of figured some things out. And it sounds like that the communication wasn't great there. But what's funny is if you've seen Buster Posey's quotes, I'm not sure they really know what to expect from Devers in San Francisco, because Posey's like, yeah, you know, we'll talk to him when he gets here about whether or not he may want to play first, which he balked at in Boston. So I hope that they're not kind of falling for the same mistake here, but I can't imagine they trade for him without sending messages through his people saying like, hey, you know, what would you be interested in doing here?
So there's that. I don't think they were, to my knowledge, they were not granted a window to talk to him. And I can kind of glean that from the idea that he was kind of blindsided a little bit by the timing and the happening of this. So the comments he made yesterday afternoon to the Boston media after the game do not indicate to me that they had actively talked to him. Now, there have been reports around today from Sean McAdam and some other folks that the Giants and the Red Sox had been talking about a Devers trade for some time, that the active negotiations had been going on for several weeks, but they had talked as far back as the offseason. My sense is that the Red Sox may have wanted out of this contract before they ever signed Bregman.
Which is very interesting, and also at the same time, it gives Devers all of the reason to have been upset at that situation, because it seems like it was a more of a trust issue than anything else. Of hey, you know, they're not talking to me for a reason, and now I kind of see what's going on here. So for him to get upset, it sounds like it wasn't just about Bregman or about the position, it was probably also about the lack of trust that he had in their communication.
So I think there's some levels of complexity to kind of who is at fault here. I would not fully blame either the Red Sox or Devers. There's like the Reddit, am I a bleep? I forget what I'm all to curse on here. And one of the answers that you can give is everybody sucks here, and that, you know, I kind of like it. I think there's a bit of fault on both sides in the dissolution of this pairing. I don't think the Red Sox handled this well, like at all, from a player management perspective. I don't think Devers did himself any favors with some of his comments, some of his reported unwillingness to have any defensive flexibility at all. I don't know how much of that was driven by him. I don't know how much of that was driven by, you know, this team that I signed with when I'm 16 isn't treating me fairly anymore after they deemed me the star they were going to keep. Screw these guys. Like that is an understandable reaction, right?
Yeah, you know? Totally. And you know, here's another thing is you and I both dabble in fandom of professional wrestling from time to time. And there's conversations when certain wrestlers may have, you know, maybe aged out of favor on one side, but you have this other side who may be willing to take them, and you put a new sheen on them, and all of a sudden it's like, oh yeah, like new place. Maybe I'm a little bit more the person who is pushing me or promoting me is maybe a little bit bigger of a fan than my previous boss. That could also be the case here, which is, yeah, he's kind of like, he was the last guy left from the World Series team. If the club wants to continue moving forth and they just brought up the top prospect in all of baseball. And now you're trying to move forward. Yeah, this guy who's been there forever, he's not the new hotness anymore. Maybe some of the things that he was that were faults that you were like, it's fine. Maybe those faults are a little bit bigger and brighter when you're trying to move in a different direction. But to the Giants, they're like, we'll take the faults because we don't have the other stuff that he gives that he gives us.
So, and I've definitely thought of this a couple times over the last 26 hours since this all broke. You know, there are, this like does feel a little bit like CM Punk and AEW, right? Like, you know, like this is just like a breakdown of communication where like just like every side here like just looks like absolutely terrible, right? But that being like, it's so, if you go back, like, and we'll do a brief history of why Rafael Devers is no longer a Boston Red Sox, right? So this is a contract that was signed several off seasons ago, when Chaim Bloom was running baseball operations for the Red Sox. And this was a surprisingly large extension at the time it was signed. It was 10 years and I think $315 million. It was over 300. And this was considered a surprisingly large contract at the time it was signed. And the feeling, I think, of a lot of people around baseball was that the Red Sox felt that they needed to make a statement that they were actually going to keep one of their stars, because they traded Mookie, which has turned into a disaster. They got nothing particularly good back for him, and he's been phenomenal in the 5 years since they traded him, right? Like, if you're a Giants fan, you're still pissed off that the Red Sox traded Mookie Betts.
Not only are you pissed off that they got such a fantastic player, he's not even hateable. He's like the great personality, very likable guy. I literally want to see him fail as a Giants fan, but then as a baseball fan, I'm like, no, like, he's everything that you like about baseball is in Mookie Betts.
Right. You know, he'll play any position. He might not play him particularly well, but he's going to try really hard. He plays through injuries. He seems like a nice, fun-loving guy. Like, there's just, he's a charismatic guy. He's fun to watch hit, just all that type of stuff. Then they let Xander Bogaerts walk, and this is the part of the narrative where, like, the Red Sox are always making incorrect decisions to dump their stars falls apart, because they let Bogaerts go to San Diego, and that might be the worst contract in baseball now. Like, if it's not the worst one, it's pretty far up there. Like, that's a disaster. He hasn't been any good out there, and he signed through the end of time for big money. But I think there was a feeling organizationally that they had to keep somebody, and they had to make a big statement, and that Devers was the guy they chose to give the big extension to. And, you know, Devers has said publicly, more recently, that there were certain assurances given to him at the time of the extension by Chaim Bloom, who at the time was running baseball operations for the Red Sox. And one of the assurances was that he was going to be the long-term third baseman. They weren't going to ask him to move to first base or DH. So Chaim gets let go. He's currently the number two guy in St. Louis, but it's already been announced he's going to become the number one guy after the season, succeeding John Mozeliak. And, you know, the reasons the Red Sox have shuffled through a lot of guys running their front offices. You know, we can have a discussion about whether Chaim got a fair shake or not. A lot of people didn't think he did. Some people did. And kind of similar to Zaidi, right? I think Bloom's probably better at this than Zaidi was.
But did he go to the rival team like Zaidi did?
No, he went to the Cardinals. So, and also his job with the Cardinals is at a higher level than Zaidi's with the Dodgers, and he has a path back to running a team immediately, and Zaidi doesn't.
Someone asked Zaidi the other day about being a double agent, and he's like, if I'm a double agent, I did a really bad job because the Giants are in first place tied with the Dodgers right now.
So, Craig Breslow gets hired away from the Cubs to run the Red Sox front office as the president of baseball operations or chief baseball operations. This title drift has become completely absurd. I think he's president of baseball operations. I don't really care. He's running the Red Sox front office.
This is the guy who Devers kind of butted heads with.
Right. So this is, he's hired from the Cubs. He was a relief pitcher. He was considered the smartest player at the time he played. He went to Yale, I think. He was one of the first players that got really into like his own analytics and biomechanics. So pretty much the second he retired, he was pegged as a future GM, president of baseball operations. He rose through the ranks very quickly. He is, despite his status as a former player, about the same age as Buster Posey, the exact opposite from Buster Posey in terms of what he wants at. He is very quantitatively focused. He is very processed focused, very focused on value, establishing value, has done a complete overhaul of the Red Sox scouting and analytics. Less so their player development. Heim Bloom is a player development specialist. That is what he is best at. So he really got their player development in tip-top shape, and they've gotten some really nice outcomes with guys like Roman Anthony and Christian Campbell and Marcel Meyer and so on. And also some prospects they've traded, but their scouting maybe lagged a little further behind in their analytics, you know. So those were the things that Breslow focused on. He took a really hardline analytical stance on a lot of this stuff, with maybe a little less of a soft touch with both player and staff personnel. There was a column by Jun Lee on Yahoo today detailing an incident that he had with one of the guys that ran their, I believe it was their pro scouting department, where they ended up exchanging curse words and the guy got fired, like on like a public Zoom. He did, the scouting coordinator didn't realize Breslow was still on the call and did an F-bomb towards him, which, yeah, this is just like this is a dysfunctional workplace thing, right? Yeah. Like this is, you know, we talked a few minutes ago about AEW and CM Punk. Like these were the type of stories that you heard CM Punk complain about AEW, right? So, but if you've ever worked, if you've ever worked in a workplace like this, these stories are mundane. Baseball front offices are workplaces with workplace politics, just like everybody else.
Sure, like absolutely. Don't
really, like, yeah, I have friends of mine that work in front offices that just like vent at me about like their office politics in the exact same way I do, like my coworkers at my real life job.
Sure,
right? So, yeah. So that's, you know, so they go out and they sign Alex Bregman to essentially a 1-year deal. It's kind of a 3-year deal. It's not really a 3-year deal. It's a 1-year deal.
Giants fans very much are aware of the 1-and-1 deals out there, or anything with a player's option, because Michael Conforto cashed in on his player option and did nothing for the Giants for 2 years. So Giants fans are very aware of those deals.
Or the other way, you know, Blake Snell pitched great for you for a year. And then,
for half a year. He was like the best pitcher in baseball for half a year.
That's the Blake Snell experience. He's hurt, awful, or incredible. Those are the three options. There's no just good. It's always one of the three. Right now he's hurt, obviously. And he was awful earlier in the season, and he'll probably come back.
He's probably going to be
great innings down the stretch.
Awesome. Right? So, he's going to be so awesome in the second half. That scares me.
Breaking news coming in from Bet365, and it's no surprise. Same game parlay from Bet365 just keeps getting better.
Well, it's even easier to make a bet. Choose from the most popular markets like hits, run line, totals, and home runs. So many to choose from.
Download the app, start building your bet, and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
So they signed Bregman, and Bregman is mostly a third baseman, but also sometimes plays second base. He was a shortstop back in college. And I don't know whether they faked this or not, but they said that this was kind of all an open and fluid situation and left the door open for Devers to play third base and Bregman to play second base. And like 5 minutes into spring training, it became obvious that Bregman was just the third baseman. And as best as anyone can tell, based on Devers' public comments, this was not something that they relayed to him ahead of time. And then there was a discussion where it was like, okay, we want you to DH this year. And he lost his mind, basically, because he was promised he was the third baseman. He, I'm sure, in his head, views himself as a as, you know, a star third baseman. Now, an important thing to note at this point is that Rafi Devers is a terrible defensive third baseman. Absolutely horrible. Probably
I had a buddy reach out to me, and he was like, so is there a chance Chapman moves around? I was like, there's zero chance. No, Chapman is fantastic, and Devers is not. So don't worry about that.
And, you know, probably much easier to swallow when you got traded to a team who already has an incumbent third baseman signed for a long period of time who is a Gold Glove player, right? So I am guessing that is a situation where he is more likely to be deferential than he is. The Red Sox signed a guy a week before spring training opened and didn't talk to me about it, right? There's personnel management there involved where, you know, you have to, and the Red Sox, both at the front office and field staff level, have been criticized for this. This is not the only time this has happened. One of the longest running jokes in baseball is that the Red Sox always shiv their players on their way out. They also did this to Terry Francona, their former manager, where the second a guy looks like he's leaving, there's stories all about how he was a terrible teammate, about how he didn't comply with what they wanted to do, this and this and that. This is a tradition going back decades and decades. certainly to the beginning of the Fenway Sports Group ownership and even beyond that at some point. But this is, you know, this is something that happens. The Red Sox tend to have an overwhelmingly large amount of acrimonious divorces from big name people. So this kind of like just drags on for like a lot of spring training. Like Devers doesn't play in a lot of spring training and just like won't say whether he's willing to DH. And then eventually he comes back as the DH. He has like the worst first week. And like, I don't know if you remember this, but he had a contact and strikeout rate that was like abnormally awful. Like he had one of the worst weeks in like recent baseball memory the first week of the season.
It was like 19 at bats to start the season and 15 strikeouts.
Something like that. It was bizarre. And that's probably weighted down some of the contact numbers we're going to discuss in a few minutes too. And I don't know how much of that was impacted by his lack of readiness for the season based on this weird feud that he was having with the team. It looked like a lot of that stuff had been put behind them. Then Tristan Casas suffers a catastrophic leg injury. Tristan Casas was their starting first baseman. The team went to Devers and said, hey, can you start taking reps at first base? And he said, no. Then John Henry flew out to meet the team and tried to like make amends for the situation. And that, as best as I can tell, just made everything worse.
By the way, if you think Breslow is like trying to soften any of this on the way out, Jeff Passan tweeted a little while ago about succeeding without him in 2025. Breslow said, I do think there's a real chance that at the end of the season, we're looking back and we've won more games than we otherwise would have.
I forgot. They're actually doing the press conference with Breslow and Sam Kennedy as the team president as this is happening.
So. Yeah. So, I mean, to some extent, he's basically saying we're better off without him,
I'm going to read a few quotes off of here. Asked if Devers requested a trade, Breslow says Devers' camp at a certain point expressed that a fresh start could be good for both sides. Like, this is like the weirdest corporate speak in like the history of like anything, right? Sam Kennedy declines to say specifically what the Red Sox wanted from Devers that he was unwilling or unable to do. So here's the thing. You're talking on the record and you're refusing to answer these questions, but these answers are getting out on background in everybody's articles about this, not like you're refusing to talk. You're just doing this weird corporate speak in public while then everybody knows where the stories are coming from. The stories that are making Devers look bad are not coming from the Devers camp. The stories that are making the Red Sox look bad are not coming from the Red Sox camp. Like, you're working the media. Both sides are working the media here. So the situation continues to go downhill because then Alex Bregman gets hurt and he also refuses to play third base. And as this is happening, Devers, who has never been the most media-friendly player on the planet to begin with, starts not really... is giving very sparse media answers, spends a lot of time hiding in the trainer's room, ducking. You know, the general expectation, especially for star players, is that you're going to talk after most games unless there's a really bad reason not to. And Devers had been talking to the media once every few weeks, once a month, something like that. He clearly did not want to talk about any of this. Yeah. And again, I don't necessarily blame him, but maybe that's not really the way you want to handle it if you want to salvage the relationship. So,
I mean, even Big Poppy, who was trying to be kind to Devers, but who
works for the Red Sox,
also a Red Sox employee.
Yeah.
Like, you could see him trying to like straddle the line without really blaming each side, but he did kind of say, you know, in some ways that, you know, maybe some of this when Devers is a little older, he could reflect back on it and kind of see maybe where he could have done a better job. All those things are probably true. He's 28-year-old dude. He has kind of grown up in this league. But at the end of the day, I'm sure some of the frustration of, again, it's like they treated me in a certain way, and now they're not treating me in the same way. You know what's actually kind of interesting? And this is what I was thinking about a little bit. Well, because we're going to get to his cons as a player in a second. But you remember when Pablo Sandoval left the Giants and the Red Sox signed him to big money that they had to eat. And I remember thinking, like, you know, Pablo is such a gregarious baseball player that we are going to miss his joy on the field. But on his way out, he was very frustrated with maybe the lack of love that the ownership was showing him as he was in his free agent time period. And not to say that, you know, this could be karmic in any way, but, you know, the thing that I worry a little bit about the Devers situation is that, you know, Buster Posey sees this as kind of the opposite of Brezel, like you said. There's a personnel management thing that I think Buster believes that he's really good at because he was a player for this organization. And it's something that Farhan was not great at, right? Farhan sort of saw just chess pieces and he's like, okay, we're going to move this guy. I mean, there were moments over the last 5 years where he was making a move like once every 2 or 3 days, and then he would make that move. The guy wouldn't even suit up, and then he'd have him gone already and bring someone else in. So there was like this chess, you know, players are pieces, players are not players. And Buster takes it maybe over the top on the other side of it, which is, no, we need to treat these guys like ball players. And so he was interviewed by Tim Kawakami, and Tim Kawakami asked him about the Zach Wheeler for Carlos Beltran trade. If you remember, Buster was out for all but like 2 months of that season because he got his knee wrecked by, was it Scott Cousins' slide at home plate?
Yeah.
And so Buster was gone. So the Giants had such a great pitching staff that they were able to stay above water while Buster was not playing. And so they went after it. They went and got Beltran, and Buster to this day, so this is like 2 or 3 weeks ago, said, yeah, as a player, I loved that trade because it showed that management thought we were good and they wanted to give us every chance to defend that World Series title. So that's the Buster perspective, is he's got a clubhouse full of guys who may not be the perfect roster, but you're showing faith in them as, no, you guys are actually a good team. I need to help you guys and give you guys the reinforcements. And so it's just a different way and, you know, opposite of how the Red Sox are doing it. And I'm not saying one way is better than the other. I am sure that Buster's going to make some mistakes here by leaning too hard in that way. But at the same time, that is what he feels as a player who was on the field only 4 years ago at the same time. So it's just an interesting little kind of nugget that I think relates very well to the big picture and how Buster sees things.
I'll make a couple of points related to that. One is that this is a 28-year-old, extremely talented guy who became disgruntled in his job because he did not have alignment with the organizational priorities. Management changed all of this. If you're viewing this just from the perspective of any type of job, if you take somebody at that age who's extremely talented, but maybe a little bit mercurial, a little bit disgruntled, things of that nature, and you put them in a much more supportive environment, you may get much better performance out of them. Like, that's not an unreasonable thought. Baseball players are human. I think we lose when we start reducing everything to, you know, a model based on its own contact rate and an exit velocity and a plate discipline model and this model and athleticism proxies and that model. You know, we can lose a little bit of that. There's a lot of soft factors involved here. That being said, Devers has had one of the best offensive half seasons of his career, so it doesn't actually seem like this has terribly affected him. The other thing I would say about Posey, one, this is actually going to be two slightly separate points. As an outside person who writes about baseball, who's a fan of another team, I think from an aesthetic perspective, it's absolutely awesome that there's somebody out here that's not crunching every number down on a spreadsheet and is just going, hey, I really want that guy. Let me go get that guy. That's great, right? You know, it's great that there's some variety, that there is a big spending, big star hunting team that's not using the exact same model that essentially any of us in the analytics side can reverse deconstruct, because it's not that hard to reverse deconstruct based on what the teams are doing, how what teams are valuing these days. Even if, for my analyst cap, I largely agree about the valuations of the players, but all of this is fake. Like, the dollars per war number is fake. The war number is fake. All of these are artificial constructs. And at some level, that this is, these are grown men wearing pajamas, hitting a ball with a piece of wood, right? All of this is fake, right? It's all kayfabe. So like everything here is an artificial construct. And if you just want to live in a slightly different reality, that actually makes things a little bit more fun. So from an outside perspective, I think it's fun, if nothing else. But I do think, especially if you're going to be a team that is only going to be the 19th best team at running the same type of organization that 25 other teams are running, which is the rut that the Giants got stuck in with Zaidi, that there might be actual value to just zagging in the complete opposite direction and pushing all of your chips in with a different kind of team construction. I don't know. That's like a weird, like logic game almost. Like, there's like non-cooperative logic involved there. But if you are not going to be able to compete with the Dodgers doing what the Dodgers do, but just doing it much worse than the Dodgers, maybe you can compete with the Dodgers by doing something dramatically different than what the Dodgers are doing. It's a different way of finding value. Maybe the best value for you is in players who are really good but going to age terribly, and you just load everything into the next three or four seasons. And that's a perfectly fine way to construct a baseball team. There's nothing wrong with that. That being said, I mean, look, a lot of the things Posey has done, like in individual context, are kind of confusing to me. I don't think he values players in the same way that I do. But that's fine. Maybe he's right. He's pretty smart, too. All right. You know, I'm just some bozo on the internet, and he's a Hall of Fame player. So maybe he's right. But he's not valuing them in the same way that the Red Sox or, you know, look, I'll put it this way. I was having a discussion in a group chat I'm in that contains a lot of people who roughly have the same mindset that I do about baseball. And a couple of months ago, when all of the Devers stuff was going south, we started talking about potential trade destinations for Rafael Devers. And like 80% of the people in the group chat said, yeah, he's going to be a Giant if he gets traded. Like, this was not difficult to guess. Like, if you looked at Rafael Devers' contract and his profile, the vast majority of teams were going to conclude that he is significantly overpaid over the course of his tenure. So you have to start looking for an organization that, one, cares less about the modeled traits of how players age over the course of the remaining eight seasons of Devers' contract. And two, what teams are good now, because a team that's bad now is not going to trade for Devers. Like, right, like the Angels in a vacuum are also one of these teams, but are the Angels really going to go all in right now? And they're having a better season than people expected, but if they were going to go all in on somebody, it would have been Ohtani, and they didn't. So, some of the teams that have this philosophy, like the Royals and the Rockies, are teams that kind of are philosophically aligned with the Giants right now. The Rockies and the Royals were never taking this amount of money, right? Like, they just weren't. So it has to be a free spending team, which is presently good and might be willing to overlook the flaws in his profile that may project him to be worth $50, $75 million if you stick this contract into a model. And the team that stuck out, the two teams that stuck out were the Giants and the Blue Jays, and the Blue Jays had just given Vlad $500 million, and putting Devers and Vladdy on the same team over the long term is going to be a disaster, because they're both going to be DHs within a relatively short period of time. They're too similar as players. So yeah, the Giants were, it was not, if you had asked me at 12 PM yesterday, Rafael Devers is going to get traded, the Red Sox aren't going to eat any money, what team is he going to? I would have said the Giants. Like, that would have been my prediction.
Yeah, it seemed to fit very well. And I know there was some conversations going on about whether or not there were other teams who were asking about Devers. And it seemed like that was maybe the Giants' leverage, is that they were going to eat the money. They weren't going to request that Boston has a percentage or pays off of a percentage or whatever it is. And maybe those other teams that you were talking about, that's part of the equation for them, is no, we're not going to take the whole thing. Like, we may take a lot of it, but you know, then you have to give us something else as well. Like, all of these different negotiations. And the Giants were just like, yeah, the money thing is not really what we're worried about, though. At the same time, it is going to bite them in the butt, which is why we're going to get to the cons here in a second. So the pros, as we said it, is Buster Posey leaning in, showing his team that he believes that they are worth adding the offensive piece that they need. And they probably do need another one, actually. We'll see what happens at the trade deadline.
The biggest pro of all, and this should be the takeaway for every Giants fan listening to this. Rafael Devers is a freaking great baseball player. Like, he is one of the best players in the league. He is definitionally one of the best hitters in the league.
I think his OPS is like 12th in all of baseball right now, or something like that.
And he is true talent at that level. He has been one of the best hitters in baseball for basically his entire career, which at this point is 7 or 8 years.
And if he's playing tomorrow, I will be there, because I'm going to Tuesday and Wednesday. I'll see his first game.
That's pretty cool. He's having a great, but this is a great baseball player. That is the biggest pro here. This is the type of player who did not exist on your team, who, if Bryce Eldridge ends up being a Rafael Devers caliber hitter, that's a huge major win. Like, that is not a reasonable expectation. There's nobody else in the system other than maybe Joshua Gonzalez who has this type of upside. Joshua Gonzalez is not going to be a major leaguer this decade, most likely. He is in the Dominican Summer League. If he is up by 2029, he went pretty fast, right?
Yeah, the kid is 17 years old right now.
So. Yeah, so that's a longer-term developmental project. In an absolute best-case scenario where he tears through the minors, he's maybe a player for you in like 2028 or 2029. And that's an absolute best case scenario.
So best player that they could possibly add to the team who was available. He should perform for the rest of the season for them. I think he's actually going to hit favorably in that park. Like you said, he may lose a couple of home runs here and there, but there's going to be some balls that he smokes off of that off of that wall in right field and sitting on second base nicely. Okay.
One of the top power hitters in the league has improved his batted ball directions. He's hitting the ball in the air more this year. He's improved his plate discipline. He's become a more selective hitter while still maintaining his same level of high aggression in the zone. These are all really, really, really positive assets to his player profile. They just might not age great once he gets into like 32,
33, 34. Okay, so let's talk about that. You were on Blue Sky yesterday tweeting or posting about zone contact. And explain to folks what zone contact is and why that showed up on your radar as you were looking at stuff about him.
So this is one of the most important analytic tools that we have when evaluating hitters. It's the percentage of swings that you make within the strike zone that result in contact versus swing and miss, right?
Okay.
So this is only pitches within the strike zone. So on the box on your television screen, this is the pitches within, you know, the little box, right?
So all the pitches that Casey Schmidt swings at that are not in the strike zone and he misses would not be in this.
That is Ocon. That's a different thing. Devers' Ocon is really good. His Z-Con is really bad, which is weird. It's been weird for a while. Those two things are usually pretty highly correlated, because usually it's a general reflection of your bat to ball. Over the last two seasons, so previous to 2024, Devers had had mediocre in-zone contact rates. They were okay. A friend of mine, Ben Zeidman, who used to work for BP and ironically now works for the Boston Red Sox, wrote an article when he was still at BP describing zone contact rate as shelves, basically. So like if you're above a certain percentage, you could expect to have this type of hit tool. Then a couple points higher, if you're above that shelf, you could expect to have that. Devers is basically below all of the shelves already. He's in a zone for in-zone contact where basically every player who shares his in-zone contact rate is absolutely horrible. Can't hit. They don't make enough contact to be productive major league players. He has been carrying a sub 75% in-zone contact rate since the beginning of 2024. Anything below about 80 is alarming. Major league average is usually around 83. There is no, like, this is like Joey Gallo's in zone contact rates were like trending like in this direction.
And Devers did strike out. He did strike out the most ever in his career last year.
Right. So this is a concerning number and also concerning in a specific way relative to his aging. Now, this has not mattered. He hits the ball so hard. He hits the ball in the air so much that this has not mattered for him yet. Typically, players who have bad in-zone contact rates, and especially if had declines in their in-zone contact rates during their prime, this is pretty frequently something that happens to a player when they start to have the earliest signs of physical decline and they just absolutely start selling out for power.
Mm-hmm.
Once you've had the first signs of physical decline, there's usually more physical decline coming. And, you know, baseball players tend to peak generally between like 25 and 28. Endeavors is 28. So there is some, let's say, contact-based collapse hit where at some point if he starts making even a little less contact than he is, he's going to have a really hard time keeping his strikeout rate from skyrocketing and his batting average from cratering. That is the downside risk. It is why he was available. If his in-zone contact rate was still 80%, the Red Sox, even with all of this drama, absolutely never would have traded him. Because that projection, the combination of traits which was causing teams to model him poorly, low in-zone contact rate, defensive struggles that have gotten worse and moving down the defensive spectrum at a relatively young age. That combination of traits might suggest that this guy is not going to be a productive major league player in his mid-30s, and he is signed into his late-30s.
Yes.
So that is why he was available in this situation. I do not think, as a Giants fan today, that you should give any care to that at all. I do not think it is worth particularly caring that the Giants are probably paying $50 million too much, because I think we're probably, from the Giants' perspective, in what I would call the unique widget territory. If you didn't trade for Rafael Devers, who on earth are you trading for? So you're going to trade for Rhys Hoskins to perform the same role, and he's going to be way worse, and you maybe lost your one shot to actually do something this year, next year, the year after. And great, you've saved some value that can be put back into the team in 2033. Who gives a hoot? Like, you know, so from the Giant fan perspective, I think it's interesting to know why he was made available from a baseball side. I also think it's interesting to know why he was made available from a non-baseball side. But I think he's probably still going to be really, really good this year, next year, 2027, for the short term. Mm-hmm. And this is pretty clearly a short-term star play. A lot of these mega contracts that go forever go bad halfway through the contract. The value is usually loaded on the front side of the deal. And I think you can kind of evaluate this as like an 8 or a 9 year free agent contract from that perspective, where yes, they are going to be paying him X number of dollars per year until then. But if you think about it, they're kind of like paying $50 million for the early years and then $10 million for the later years, sure, based on what they're expecting to get back, right? That's not, and there's also like present value of money considerations. Like by 2032, the amount of money he's going to be making is going to be a smaller percentage of whatever cap or cap-like system exists at that time. This is the same thing that happened. You're a big NBA fan, right? Mm-hmm. This is the same thing that's happened in the NBA. Contracts that were signed 5 years ago that may have looked like overpays 3-4 years ago, right, by the end of the contract can sometimes no longer overpays anymore because the cap keeps going up.
Right.
That's happened even more aggressively in hockey, where contracts that were hockey similar. So NBA contracts are limited to 5 years. Hockey contracts are limited to 8 years, and contracts that were signed 6 or 7 years ago that looked extravagant at the time didn't turn out to be extravagant.
And let's see what happens with, let's see what happens in baseball with their collective bargaining and all that stuff in the near future, because I forgot who I was reading. Somebody said, you know, the worst thing that could happen is that the Dodgers win the World Series again, because then there's actually leverage for some of these owners to kind of throw fits and stuff and have reasons as to why. Like, I find it very interesting that a lot of these teams do go for that, like, 10-year contract. But I think a lot of it is because of what you just said, is that you don't know what the TV deals and all that stuff is going to look like. But we're having issues with ESPN opting out of the major league deal and them having to figure out how to make up a lot of that money. And then we have all of these RSNs and trying to figure out the model of how people are going to watch the stuff. So there is some influx there. And while my preference or my hope would be that in 5 to 10 years, they would figure out all of those things and baseball would be very well in sort of economics. I'm only confident in the economics of baseball if I'm the Dodgers and the Yankees and, you know, maybe the Mets and a couple of other teams. Otherwise, I'm like, I don't know what to think in 5 years.
What are the economic, you know, the economics of the country matter too. Like, we're in an economic turmoil, right? Like, consumer confidence is its lowest. The value of the dollar is going down. We have no idea how that's going to play out over the next, you know, 8.5 years that are remaining on the Devers contract. Like, there's just,
I'm here worried about baseball.
Right, exactly, right. This is the bigger thing, yeah. You know, I'm gonna steal a line from Donald Rumsfeld of all people. These are all the known unknowns, right? Like, this is all the stuff that we know is gonna impact this, but we don't know how.
So
I'm sure those are considerations for teams too. I'll be honest, I don't know the Giants RSN situation off of the top of my head.
It's fine. It's definitely fine for now, but
right. That means it's not a cluster because the ones I know about are pretty much all clusters. So, I have not heard about them in like bankruptcy proceedings.
I mean, the RSN situation is literally the only reason why the A's can even exist is because they get so much money from the RSN for a deal that they signed years and years and years ago.
And they get their revenue sharing payments from other teams' RSNs too.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, and the economics of baseball, you know, Manfred is actively trying to reshape the economics of baseball right now. Like, that's something that he is doing. He's trying to centralize media rights. There's a lot of discussions about the value of cashing out on streaming versus the exposure of the major cable networks, all of the same stuff that's happening in any sport or entertainment right now, because they're all having the same discussions. They're all seeing that the media money is starting to dry up, the fragmenting of, you know, we went through the streaming era to basically just recreate cable, but now they're over the internet. Like, that's what happened, right? Now you pay for 26 different streaming services, and everything is fragmented. We have every streaming service on the planet, right? My wife used to be an entertainment writer. She is now a sports editor. So, like, we have everything. It would pain me to actually tally up how much we're paying between cable and streaming for everything.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But, like, you know, all this stuff is, you know, if you want to watch every baseball game, even sometimes just every, depending on what team you're a fan of, every baseball game for a team, you may need 3, 4, 5, 6 different, you know, between cable channels and streaming services. You know, the Yankees have given some of their exclusive home rights to Amazon Prime, so you can't watch them unless that you've got Amazon Prime. The national exclusive games are fragmented between different places.
Yeah.
You know, ESPN has some, Fox has some, Apple TV has some. They're on Fubo TV, I think, for Sunday, but they're also free on there, so it doesn't matter quite as much.
The Roku deal is the one that seems to have these media companies up in arms. The fact that they were able to sell for pennies on the dollar just to kind of get into that business, which seems to be a bad decision in hindsight.
Right, and they're just like, that's just like one game a week on Sunday morning, but then it had the knockdown effect of they made everybody else push their start times back on Sunday and the whole thing's just...
And if you're baseball, you're like, well, the reason why we did that is because this was the package that no one wanted, so we didn't have any leverage for it.
Right, but then ESPN's going, you know, what the heck, we're paying you way more for similar inventory, it's like, so what's going on? So, like, from that perspective, like, should you as a Giants fan care that this contract's probably gonna suck in 5 years? I do not think you should care about that at all. I think it's perfectly fine to be aware of it, but I don't think it, you know, it, from the perspective that I analyze baseball, it's interesting to analyze. It's interesting to think about why the Red Sox wanted out of this deal, other than they had an employee that they were no longer on the same page as why they might have been willing to push that. But from a Giants perspective, you are on June 15th, which is a time that's very difficult to trade for players who are any good. Like, players just don't get traded this time of year. Teams are focusing on the draft. They're focusing, they're starting their trade deadline prep, but they're not really out there. You know, this is an odd time for a major trade. So early on, so you're getting an extra month and a half of value as opposed to trading for him at the trade deadline, which is not inconsiderable. You've gotten a player who is very clearly going to be the best guy moved, who is, had he been a free agent this upcoming offseason, would have either been the best or second best hitter available. Probably the second best. I think Tucker's probably better as an overall player, even if he's not a better hitter, just because of the defensive value. Tucker's a you know, decent corner outfielder, whereas Devers, I don't know where they're going. You were mentioning the comments that Posey gave where they said, you know, we're going to talk to him. We're going to see if he wants to play third. We're going to see if he wants to play first. We're going to see if he wants to DH. And I think that's kind of, you know, Chapman's out for a little while. So if he wants to play third for a little while, he can. He has barely played first base as a professional. He has played it some. I don't know if he would be particularly good there or not. It would be hard to tell until you put him out there. But he can also just DH. Like, that's fine. Like, right. He's displacing Wilmer Flores, but Wilmer Flores himself has some positional flexibility. Wilmer Flores can play second base. Wilmer Flores can play first base well and second or third base badly. He was the regular shortstop for an NL champion Mets team, but it was 10 years ago and he was bad at it then too. You know, but there's some versatility there. He's not blocking anybody until Eldridge comes up, who is really the only near-term hitting prospect that the Giants should be concerned about making room for. But if, you know, Chapman's the third baseman, Eldridge is the first baseman, and Devers is the DH long-term, I think that's fine, right? There's no problem there. And I think that's probably the long-term defensive configuration. Assuming they keep Eldridge, they could go out and move Eldridge for a star player. Who the heck knows, right? If I was a Giants fan, I would be really excited over this. I don't think any of the longer-term concerns are a reason to not be excited about the trade. And again, you should probably not care if your owners are taking a $50 million loss on a contract. It is interesting for us to talk about as analysts. As a fan, you shouldn't care.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. All right, let's spend the next couple of minutes just quick conversations about two players who are on the minds of two prospects who are on the minds of Giants fans. One, you mentioned Bryce Eldridge, will save him for last. Carson Wisenhunt is a name that I think a lot of Giants fans have circled. One of the reasons why they didn't really think that they were going to see him this year is because of the fact that Roop and Birdsong and then now Harrison were all up with the club. And it's like, okay, then, you know, Wisenhunt, now he can pitch, you know, most of the season in AAA, and then you bring him up late. Is it, do you see him with the club, or how do you think the Giants view him, or do they want him to just stay in AAA and look towards next year, maybe when someone like Verlander or Robbie Ray's future isn't as set in stone? Like, what do you think about Carson Wisenhunt?
So I think he's a 2025 player for them, right? He's thrown like almost 200 innings in AAA at this point, which is a lot. And he's pitched pretty well at AAA this year, which he did not last year.
Right.
I am a moderate Carson Wisenhunt fan. I liked him out of the draft as a player. There were makeup reasons he fell to the Giants in the 2022 draft. And I
makeup reasons, huh?
I forget how much they have been publicly reported on, which is why I said generic makeup reasons. So let's do
the failing of steroid
test. Let's do the 5 second. Yeah, let's do the five. Yeah, failed drug test. Okay, failed PED test. So that's public. So I can comment on. Yeah, he flunked a drug test in college. And he, you know, he fell to the Giants in the second round. He was generally considered a first round talent. He kind of had a blowaway 2023 season and amid some injuries. Then he wasn't as good in 2024 at AAA. AAA is weird right now because of rules they have put in place both to make it more like the major leagues from an equipment and umpiring standard, but they've also used it as a testing ground for the automatic strike zone. Which has made some things kind of screwy in terms of analyzing player results, because there's just, it's just, it's also kind of just a high-end run environment. AAA has been that recently, both in the PCL and increasingly in the International League, but the Giants are in the PCL. They've always been in the PCL, and their AAA park is, you know, it's a hitter-friendly park in a hitter-friendly league, right? Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. Pitchers don't always perform well on the Giants' farm system once they, you know, really at several minor league levels, actually, you know, San Jose and A-ball is...
unless your name is a Tim Lincecum and Madison Bumgarner, you don't usually blast through them.
And Sacramento, which they are sharing with the A's, is, you know, it's the PCL, and it's not a super pitcher-friendly park within the PCL either. And you also throw in the general things that are causing the run environment there. Yeah. So Wisenhunt's got a really great changeup. That's his bread and butter pitch. He throws it almost 40% of the time. He throws it almost as much as he throws his fastball. It's a really great pitch shape. It's a really nice changeup. It gets a lot of swings and misses. It gets a lot of chases out of the strike zone. That is his best pitch by 4 scouting grades, probably. He has a borderline plus-plus changeup, and he has nothing else, which is clearly even average. Like, he has kind of a generic, not great fastball. Like, he throws in the low 90s up to the mid 90s. His fastball shape is bad. Hitters make a lot of contact against it. It's like, so from that perspective, you're almost thinking like this is like a crafty lefty changeup heavy profile. Like, mm-hmm. This has been a, you know, that's kind of true. And, you know, the crafty lefties of our childhoods through like 86, and now we're saying crafty lefty for a guy who like averages 93 and hits 96, all right? So that's a crafty lefty is now like 92 to 94, right?
Right.
Which is weird, but it's also true. He would really be helped if you found a consistent and better breaking ball, mm-hmm. Which is a tough thing to do. The below average fastball trades change up heavy profile is not a cohort that I like a ton, because if there's any degradation within the change up quality at the major league level, you have nothing else to fall back on. So right. It's almost like a binary yes, no. Is this change up going to just fool guys at the major league level? And it's very hard to tell that until you see the pitcher at the major league level. In some ways, that's also like what Kyle Harrison's been struggling with over the last couple of years, right? So, you know, there was kind of a struggle there to find a consistent breaking ball that he would be able to get 20.
I mean, he still doesn't have it. He was still struggling with it.
Right. So that you might see some of those similar issues for Wisenhunt when he comes up, or he might just find the right breaking ball at some point, or his changeup might be so good that it doesn't matter. So I think there's a pretty big delta there on where he ends up being, but I absolutely would expect to see him at some point this season based on how good he's throwing in AAA, based on how long he's been at AAA. He certainly passed any organizational benchmark for innings that they might have set that they want for a guy in the high minors. So I think he is probably, especially with Harrison no longer in the organization,
right.
He's probably a near-term pitching option. His existence is probably one of the reasons they were comfortable moving Harrison in this deal, because he is in broad strokes a fairly similar pitcher to Harrison, or projects to be a fairly similar pitcher to Harrison. So you can trade some out of your organizational depth there. He is not as good of a prospect as Harrison was a couple of years ago, but based on where Harrison had been trending, he's more similar to that. I assume he's going to be a candidate for our midseason top 50. I don't think he's going to make it. We're putting out our next list in about a month, during the All-Star break. It's usually when we put him out. I don't think he's going to make it, but we haven't broken it out enough to know. He's at least somebody. He will at least be. We already have a long list of like 150 players. He's definitely on the long list. So he's maybe right now he's maybe trending towards like a back of the second half of the top 100 type pitching prospect, which very clearly makes him the second best prospect in the system.
Right,
assuming you're not totally in on the Jaguar hype after 15 games in the complex, which that one's going to take a little time for me to actually work out. But I expect to see him in the majors this year. I expect if he is in the majors, probably a median outcome would look a lot like Kyle Harrison's last 2 years. But there's definitely some significant upside. He has one of the best changeups in the entire minor leagues. And sometimes the guys who have one really high-end trait can end up significantly overperforming once they get to the majors, because if his changeup continues to perform like it has in the minors, he won't need anything else because it's that good of a pitch in the minors. But major league hitters are much better at laying off changeups than minor league hitters. That's why they're major league hitters.
All right, let's talk about the prospect that is on everybody's mind now. Bryce Eldridge had a slow start to the season. I believe he had a hand injury of some sort.
Yes.
And he played very well at AA. They moved him up to AAA. I don't think he's hit in 2 weeks. He's struggling a little bit in AAA right now, but he is the one that everyone has circled as, we don't want to see this guy go. We're keeping first base warm for him. They had hoped that maybe Lamont Wade could handle that for another year. Did not happen. He got moved out. So do you see Bryce as somebody who possibly comes up this year and helps this team? Or are we looking at now that they did trade for Devers that you don't have to put as much pressure on him to come up and help this year's club? And maybe we are looking more to next year at some point.
So essentially every time I come on this podcast, which you have me on like once or twice a year, I just gush about Bryce Eldridge for 5 minutes. So let's do that again. So Bryce Eldridge is one of the best hitting prospects in the entire minor leagues. You can make a cogent argument that bat alone, he is the best prospect left in the minor leagues. The defense, first base is a struggle for him, which is a little surprising to me. He is a really good athlete. He was drafted as a two-way player. And I think conceptually when he gave up pitching, a lot of people thought he was going to end up in the outfield. And instead, he really couldn't do anything in the outfield. And even these are like footwork problems for him at first base. His footwork is a little bit rough. It would not like super shock me if it ended up being Devers at first and Eldridge at DH long-term. Teams are really hesitant to make guys in their early 20s DHs full-time for kind of obvious reasons. So they're probably going to try not to do that. But first base has been a struggle for him. If I recall correctly, they had Will Clark go out to one of the affiliates he was playing at to try and work on his first base defense with him. Like, they've been sending people out to work on his defense. None of that will matter if he hits like we think he'll hit. So Bryce Eldridge is built like a NFL edge rusher. He's 6'7" and he's a big, athletic, strong dude. And he hits baseballs very, very far, very, very, very far. Incredible bat speed for his size, because at the size we're talking about, this is like a near Aaron Judge sized individual. That's like how big we're talking about. You're just going to swing and miss a lot. There's just too much of the strike zone to cover. You're swinging very fast with a long swing. Given his size, he has really good barrel dexterity. He's really good at aiming the barrel within the strike zone, getting the barrel towards the ball in a positive way, which, going back to our Devers discussion earlier, that manifests in contact rates that are mediocre, which is perfectly fine given how hard he hits the ball, right? Mm-hmm. He is consistently has posted average exit velocities at the top of the minor leagues in the 93 to 94 mile an hour range at ages 18 to 20. Players gain exit velocity as they get older up until age 24, 25. So if a guy is averaging 93, 94 miles an hour at age 19, at age 20, you can reasonably expect him to be at the top of the league up there with the Devers's and the Otani's and, well, not the Judges because nobody's up there with Judge. you know,
yeah, he's
O'Neill
kind of
Cruz, Junior Caminero, like the top of the league exit velocity guys, you can expect continued growth into that. And he's got, for his skill set, he's got pretty good bat to ball. And the guys who combine being able to do this amount of damage to the baseball with having a decent enough hit tool often just become offensive stars. Like his, you know, his a pretty good case offensive production, he might put up seasons that look a lot like Rafael Devers' seasons, mm-hmm. right? Like that's, you know, that's the type of offensive upside that we're talking about with him. And yeah, he's been terrible for 2 weeks at AAA. He's running a 160 BABIP, which is just, it happens. It's a short sample size. Like his underlying batted ball metrics are absolutely fine in that time period. Just sometimes players have a bad week or two. It's nothing to freak out about. In his AAA sample this year, he's had an 82.3% in zone contact rate, which is about league average, a little bit below, as we discussed before. His average exit velocity is 93.4, which is among the top numbers at AAA. His plate discipline numbers are well above average, and he's already hit a ball 112 miles an hour in 2 weeks. So, yes, he's hitting under the Mendoza line, but it also doesn't mean anything. It's 2 weeks, and all of the underlying numbers are still really awesome. Yeah, he is one of the best offensive prospects left in the minors. The defense, he's probably going to be limited to first base, and he might not be particularly good there. And if he hits, who cares? Because he might hit a ton. He is one of the, you know, Roman Anthony, who you were talking about, who was the top prospect that the Red Sox got called up, was the only guy in the minor leagues that could match, like, the just enormous, demonstrable power upside. You know, Roman Anthony had run a 95 average exit velocity at the same age, which is just astounding. You know, so Anthony could go toe-to-toe with him in terms of, like, present demonstrated power, but he was the only guy in the minors that could. You know, there's guys that might have power potential, like a Sebastian Walcott in the Rangers system, but he hasn't really demonstrated on the field yet. His is more youth-based, physical projection-based. Mm-hmm. Eldridge is already there. Eldridge, again, this is a guy who, you know, if you put pads and a jersey on him, you'd think he was playing edge rusher for, like, Florida, right? Like, that's the type of physicality we're talking about. So, yeah, he's one of the top offensive prospects. Whether or not he's going to be ready this year, again, he's in AAA. If you're in AAA for a contender and the major league team thinks you can help the major league team, they're going to call you up.
Right.
So I would not be surprised at all to see him by the end of the season. A lot of that's going to depend on how he adjusts to AAA, because now in AAA, you're facing a lot of guys who have major league service time who can maybe throw a little bit harder than even in AA. But the keys are they can spot a changeup, they can spot right. a curveball, they can spot a slider. They're going to sequence you much better. A lot of the catchers have major league time, so they're going to put together sequences that you just haven't seen. He's going to face, you know, almost major league quality lefty specialists, which just, like, isn't something that exists. You know, the guys in A ball that are lefty relievers are generally not very good, and the guys that are in AAA that are lefty relievers are okay. So based on how he adjusts to AAA, I think that's going to tell whether or not he's in the majors this season. But I think he's definitely on the radar, and I don't think Dominic Smith or Wilmer Flores is going to be a block. So that might be a decision where you take the next 6 weeks And then at the end of July, you might be in a spot where, okay, we're calling Bryce Eldridge up, or okay, we're trading for Rhys Hoskins right now to play first base.
Like right.
That might be a determination that you can make in a month or a month and a half once you have seen how he's adjusted to left-handed spin at AAA, how he's adjusted to more velocity at AAA. I think he'll be able to make those adjustments. I would not be surprised at all if he's the regular first baseman for the Giants by like September, but it's going to be based on how he adjusts to AAA. I don't think the timing of that promotion, I think, was to give them a couple of months to assess the situation.
Sure, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So, first off, I always love it when you come on. I learn a ton. So thank you for taking time out of your day. I don't imagine talking about baseball is necessarily something you don't look forward to, but I do.
I love these hits. I love talking to you about this.
I do appreciate you coming on with us. And secondly, let us know what you're working on. What can we look forward to? And you know what's interesting? I just saw this. So I have an Apple News account. Mm-hmm. And so what Apple News is it like it licensed some content from like magazines and newspapers. Yeah. And I'm starting to see baseball prospectus content in my feeds, which is amazing. Because I'm like, oh, my gosh, like I didn't think that this was possible.
We've got content there and we've got stuff showing up on Defector. We also trade some content back and forth with them. So, yeah.
So that was fantastic. So, but let us know what you're kind of working on right now and what we can get forward to or look forward to seeing from you.
So we will have our first draft board. So the draft is also during the All-Star break. It's the Sunday of day one is Sunday of the All-Star weekend. I think that's right. It's definitely, I think it's Sunday. They keep moving it around. The draft used to be like around now, and that was just like much easier for everybody. And now they've pushed it back. I think the draft should be attached to the College World Series in Omaha, but it's not. And the College World Series is ongoing right now. We will have a draft board out sometime roughly in the next week. I need to do some more work on it. I'm working with a couple of younger guys, much younger guys on the draft board. And I need to kind of do my part. They've kind of done their part. But that should be out probably either later this week or next week. I don't know exactly when. I've got to get that sorted. It's also going to be like 10,000 words. So I'm going to have to give everybody a little time to edit it. So that'll be out pretty soon. We're starting our midseason 50 process. That'll be out probably during the All-Star. We usually put that out either the Monday or the Wednesday of the All-Star game week. Kind of tied in with the All-Star Game festivities. A lot of people like to see that. So those are the two main things that I am working on. I have a Mets-focused podcast, which I can't imagine anybody listening to this wants to hear. We did an hour. We recorded last night, and we randomly did an hour where we did like a Mike and the Mad Dog bit, like talking about presidents up to the Great Depression. So it's a weird podcast. Sometimes we talk about wrestling. Both of us are kind of disaffected with wrestling right now, so we've not been talking about wrestling as much. My podcast co-host Jeffrey is like a hardcore Dragon Gate fan, like dating back to like when it was Toriumon. So like he has, and I am more of a normie, like New Japan AEW guy. So we have divergent wrestling interests, but like both of us are like not watching a ton right now. So it's kind of about
more,
the
and there's more product in the US on television than ever.
Yes, so if you had asked me when I was a kid, like, oh my God, you can watch almost anything, I would have been like, wow, I'm going to like spend 8 hours a day watching wrestling. And now that I'm 41 years old and have a job and a wife, I spend almost no time watching wrestling.
Yes.
I know you watch more, but also you have professional reasons to watch it. So.
Yes, it is kind of like, I watch it like people would watch tape for their job. Like I'm not watching it necessarily for any sort of fandom reasons or whatever. I'm like literally watching it to look for things so that I can talk about.
Right, you're watching it in the same way that I would watch the College World Series, right?
Sure.
I may enjoy get some enjoyment out of it, but mostly I'm watching it because I need to see what Gage Wood is throwing.
Exactly.
So that podcast is For All You Kids Out There, which is a Keith Hernandez quote. We've been doing it for like 10 years. It's a disaster. But a
and I know the Mets are technically not the best team in baseball record-wise as of today, but this, you have to be happy with that ball club.
This has been a fascinating season because it's just like, I have nothing to complain about. Like, people keep complaining about, like, Mets fans keep complaining about stuff, and it's like, shut up! Like, they're really great and nothing is going wrong. Like, the worst thing that's happened to them is they got swept by the Rays this weekend, and I was at the game on Saturday, and like, yeah, they got swept by the Rays. That took them from 105-win pace to 101-win pace. Oh, darn. What a shame. But, yeah, like, nothing is – like, everything's great. They have good players. They play good baseball. It's wonderful.
Who would have thunk it? The Tigers have the best record in baseball, technically, as of this report.
Talk about a team that's made a complete turnaround in their process and their player development, everything. They're, you know, they went from a bottom-tier org to a top-tier org very quickly.
I'm happy because I don't want them to trade one of the best pitchers in baseball. I don't want to see the Dodgers end up with this dude if in any way, shape, or form.
So I have a podcast. I have a Twitter account I locked and basically don't post on anymore.
Yeah, you're a Blue Sky guy now.
And I don't particularly like Blue Sky either. What are your thoughts on Twitter versus Blue Sky or X?
I don't really do anything but promotional tweets on Twitter because there's really no community there anymore.
It's you say one wrong thing and you've got like actual Nazis tweeting at you. Yeah. Right?
Like, Blue Sky. I would like to be more on Blue Sky, but it just seems like they decided there are these number of people who don't like Twitter.
Yes.
And instead of just throwing every possible feature at Blue Sky, they're like, oh, we're just going to slow play this thing. We'll give you something once every 2 months.
I don't have group DMs there. I don't have the ability to send images in DMs there. I might have actually deleted my Twitter, except that there's like three group chats there that haven't migrated.
Yeah, and I'm sure people who you've reached out to forever have access on that, and they are not going to move over to Blue Sky.
Right, and you know, I've tried to like exchange phone numbers or contact info with people, but like you're going to lose contact. So yeah, I'm like there. I occasionally will promote something, but I also like locked my account. I probably don't need to be locked at this point. I was getting some bad stuff in my mentions, so I locked. Just because I'm 41 years old. I don't need people calling me slurs on social media. Yeah, like it's just bad. Not it's something really I care to involve myself in. Blue Sky, I find the discourse on Blue Sky to be tedious and annoying. So I'm not that like if you say even a slightly wrong thing, people will yell at you, or there's like a lot of like the I like pancakes, why don't you like waffles discourse over there. That's like a meme from like 10 years ago, but it's like people just like say like think you mean something exactly the opposite of what you meant. But in theory, my Twitter account is at jasidler, SEIDLER. My Blue Sky account is sidler.bsky.social. again, I'm putting all of my content such that it is on Blue Sky, but also I can't even remember this is just all beating the social media addiction out of me, which is
the other problem with Blue Sky is what's your Twitter handle? Some small thing. And what's your Blue Sky handle? And it's like, you don't even know. You're like, I think it's this, but I don't like, that's the other thing. That's the problem. I don't know why they did it that way. I think initially they wanted to create subdomains so that you could prove that you are someone of value and this is the website that you are attached to and stuff, but it's
like this like Federation stuff that like Mastodon started, but nobody really can't like either. Like Blue Sky, as best as I can tell, started out as like the libertarian haven for like libertarian tech bros, and then just because it was the best functioning Twitter alternative when Twitter just started completely melting down, like a lot of people went there because, I mean, good Lord, like I boot Threads up like once every week or two just because it's usually really funny, but it's like the stupidest form of a Twitter replacement.
I get tricked because I'll be on Instagram and I'll do like one scroll just to see something and then I'll be done. But then in that one scroll, I see something that's interesting. And I click on it and I was like, oh no, there's a Twitter, there's a Threads thing, and it boots the app up and I gotta shut the app and it's annoying.
I have a burner Instagram that I use to like follow a few friends that are on Instagram, and I've like very carefully curated the discovery feed to only show me baseball cards basically.
Yeah.
Because anything else, what you will eventually end up on the Instagram algorithm either getting sexually suggestive content, graphic violent content, or horrible political content, all of which I don't want to see. So I spent like a year just clicking on baseball card posts, and now it just feeds me nothing but baseball cards. It's wonderful. I just go on it sometimes to look at baseball cards. So I've successfully gotten my Instagram feed to think I'm a baseball card addict, which
there you go. I can't afford baseball cards as much anymore because they're very expensive these days, but I still enjoy I enjoy opening the pack that I can, you know, if I go to Target and I'll get a retail box for $20 just for the mere sake of the audio sounds of opening up a pack of baseball cards is still very delightful for me.
So what I do is like I eBay cards that I really wanted when I was a kid and I either couldn't afford or couldn't find. So like I picked up recently like a Topps Tiffany Bo Jackson.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Like the fun stuff. But that stuff's also like not that much money because it was massively, horribly overproduced.
It's a fun market. Like my buddy who we finally did our very first Giants versus Dodgers podcast, which we've been talking about doing years and years. We finally did it. We'll probably do like 2 or 4 a year. And I didn't realize this, but he told me that the way that he got into the Dodgers, he's in LA, but his first favorite player was Daryl Strawberry on the Dodgers. And I don't associate Strawberry necessarily on the Dodgers. Yeah. I associate with him with the Mets, obviously. But to think about, okay, in his second tour of duty with another team, that's how you became a baseball fan. So I went online on eBay and I found, I don't even know what brand it was, but there's like a few Strawberry Dodger cards autographed, and it was like $30 or something. So I just sent it to him as a thanks for helping me with some content. But it's stuff like that where you're right, it's really fun.
I got my Griffey card in my Zoom background. That's the Ken Griffey card I pulled when I was 5 years old when I was ripping Upper Deck. It's still the same card. It's not in great shape. It's still in the screw down holder from 1990 or whatever. But yeah, like that's like the type of stuff I'm just like.
That's awesome.
I got the Billy Ripken error, the famous Billy Ripken error card recently. So yeah,
but then they covered up the error and then they made even more valuable fluky error cards.
I am literally just like occasionally, like I went on a buying spree of like $15 Vince Carter rookies the other
month. There you go.
Yeah,
there you
just
go.
Like the fun stuff, right? But yeah, I'm not playing the $10,000 Jack Caglione autographed refractor number /5 game. That's the
biggest mover in sports cards, I think, right now is none other than Caitlin Clark.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Caitlin Clark's the biggest mover in pretty much anything. I just saw good friend of mine, Howard Megdahl, runs a women's sports site, The Nine and Next. And,
I like that.
They just got Ted Leonsis, the owner of the Caps and the basketball teams in Washington, just bought in as an equity partner on his site, and they're making a big it's really great to see the infusion of interest in women's sports, and especially women's basketball. I know you guys have the expansion team out there.
Yeah, well, I mean, and my son and I are
podcasting. Yeah,
we're covering it, and people are interested. There's lots of people who are just looking for content.
absolutely great that that's, you know, because that those are sports that really struggle to find a foothold. And, you know, people like Howard have been covering them for a very long time to a small audience and doing really great work. And it's finally paying off. And yeah. I think that's really wonderful.
Yeah. All right, Jarrett, thank you again. And, you know, I'll keep I like to keep in touch with you, obviously. But at some point, I was looking at the last time that we recorded, and it was right as I think as the World Series was going to start.
It was right when they hired Posey.
Right when Posey got hired is the last time we chatted. So we'll check in again, and good luck to your Mets. And I hope that both the Mets and the Giants are playing some important baseball there in October.
Might be playing against each other in October.
Oh, yeah, I would be a little scared about that.
I would be scared about that, too. The way you guys got Devers now. It's kind of scary.
All right. Thanks, Jarrett. I am Double G. We will see you when we see you. Peace out.
Breaking news, and this one is almost unbelievable.
Yeah, it's all about new customers at Bet365, because they get $150 in bonus bets when they bet $5, win or lose. And even better, bonus bets can be used on the spread, totals, and player props.
There you have it. Bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. And see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. T&Cs apply. Available in app only.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own. Surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.